Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we're going to continue with something of an informal series that we have been doing here with some of our programs, taking a look at key issues faced by the state of Illinois. And we are using as our jumping off point a report that has been put together by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. They call it the Illinois Report 2008, and it's the second time that it's been done. And it has sections on a variety of subjects: the fiscal condition of the state, health and health care, energy, infrastructure, poverty, education, and so forth. And we've done a couple of programs here with contributors to the report, and we are doing that again this morning, taking two things that are certainly distinct and different subjects and yet are related. And we thought it'd be possible to in a sense, put them together and establish some connections between the two things, one of them being poverty and the other being school funding here in the state of Illinois. And we have with us two guests, Elizabeth Powers. She's an economist here at the U of I and is also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Her area of interest is the analysis of social policies, including things like Social Security and welfare and public health insurance. So she is here to talk a little bit about the issue of poverty. And also with us is Peter Mulhall. He's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs Center for Prevention Research and Development, and has been doing that since 1997, and has done a lot of work in the areas of health, education, and prevention. And he's worked on a number of programs at various government levels that have to do with evaluations of programs and interventions that look at things like academic failure and substance abuse and related problem behaviors. And he's the guy who contributed the section in this report that looks at funding for schools, particularly here. And we're not talking about higher education. We're talking about primary, secondary education, K through 12, basically, is what we're talking about. And so as we talk with the guests, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so we can keep moving along here. But anybody who is listening is welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Good morning.
It's nice
appreciate
to be
it.
Here.
First, I thought maybe we could talk about poverty in the state of Illinois. Maybe first, just to establish our baseline here so people know what it is we're talking about, poverty is something that is defined. It's defined by the government according to households and their family income. Mm-hmm. So currently now, officially, what is the poverty?
Okay.
What is the poverty line?
Poverty is defined by the federal government for the purposes of measurement is there are different income levels defined for different types of families. So let me give you two relevant examples. For a single parent with one child, that is the federal poverty line for that unit would be set at $13,896. I'm talking about a two-parent household with two children in the household. That is right around $20,000. It's $20,444, and those are federal limits. So they're applied across the country, and the income that's counted for those purposes is pre-tax, post-transfer income.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if you take a look at, let's just look at poverty in the state of Illinois. So in the state of Illinois, how many people fall under those levels?
So in Illinois, 1.72 million people are officially poor by that standard. And that's the Illinois rate is around 13.5% currently. The U.S. rate over the comparable period, which is the last several years, is around 15.3%.
Okay. So one of the things that I know various people in this report have tried to look at is not just look at what's happening in Illinois, but make some comparison between Illinois and the nation and then Illinois and other states mm-hmm. in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it apparently when you do that, on the one hand, you can say compared to the rest of the country, Illinois is doing better. But then compared with the rest of the Midwest, Illinois is doing less well.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Illinois tends to trend, in terms of its poverty rate over longer periods of time, Illinois tends to trend along with the United States and track the United States poverty rate fairly closely. And when you look at the other states in our immediate neighborhood, there are some really low poverty states like Minnesota, Wisconsin, that tend to and Illinois tends to sit more towards the Indiana and the poorer performing in terms of poverty than the better performing states. Yeah. that I would say Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa would be good examples of the higher performing states with regard to poverty.
Any idea about why it is that difference should exist? Why, on the one hand, you'd have to say, well, Illinois is doing a little bit better than the national average, and yet somehow we're lagging behind other states in our region?
I think that Illinois faces some there are some differences with the United States as a whole, and there are some differences with the other states around us. We have urban poverty mm-hmm. problem, which is it's deep, and it seems quite stubborn. It's not shown improvement. We also have rural areas that are becoming depopulated and are leaving behind quite poor households in those areas. So I think that a lot of the contribution to this is urban poverty, but certainly not all of it.
Yeah. Maybe one other thing that we also want to make sure that we mention when we talk about look at the people that we're talking about, that is, well, who are they? That we're not generally not talking about single individuals. We're talking about families, and that significant numbers of the poor in the state of Illinois, as I suppose they are anywhere else in the United States, are children.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. So in the country over time, about a third of poor individuals are actually children in poor households. And in Illinois, that's similar. Right now, it's around 35% of all the people officially deemed poor are children under 18. And a lot of those children are in single-parent households. So in Illinois, almost a quarter of poor people are actually children who live with a lone parent who is a female. So this is a significant part of the poverty problem.
Well, I want to jump over to our other subject here for a moment, and then I'm sure we can come back and talk about some other things, particularly state programs that are aimed at trying to provide mm-hmm. assistance to people who are poor. But I think that it is true if you ask a question, well, what sort of things are likely to influence how well you're doing or how well a family is doing? They're educational level is going mm-hmm. to is going to have something to do with it. And in fact, I think that one of the things that is true about Illinois, when you ask this question, well, what affects poverty rates? One of the things I think is true in the state of Illinois is large numbers of people who have not completed high school.
Yes, that's true.
So so we can draw a line between how families are doing and how they have done in school. So let's jump over to this other subject.
I think you can actually draw a double line that's bolded, quite frankly.
Well, let me then ask the question about if you just look at the funding for public schools, look at how schools are funded in Illinois, and then particularly if you just say compare the state of Illinois with other states, how are we doing?
Well, I think Illinois is really a state that's really quite dichotomous in many ways. There's extraordinary schools in the state, the best, some of the best in the world. In fact, one here in Urbana Uni High, I guess, is considered an elite school by every measure that's out there. By the same token, of course, there's schools that don't come anywhere near close to have percentage of kids meeting the standards. And I think one of the unique aspects that now with the federal legislation, No Child Left Behind, we actually have a template that says, at least, which was essentially created under sort of the mandate from the feds, but the state legislature and the State Board of Education are saying the Illinois state standards is how we're measuring whether our kids are meeting, these academic outcomes and expectations. And so the point is now that we actually have a real metric. And now there's a lot of people who don't agree with it. There's a lot of controversy about it, and et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is there is now a metric to say how are kids doing relative to this valued output that occurs in, you know, primarily through assessments in elementary school, middle school, and then one measurement at high school. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of a unique aspect. That's one of the results of No Child Left Behind is there are this still a lot of controversy about it. Then the second question that I sort of consider when thinking about this is that are we spending enough money to meet the standards? Well, there's large numbers of schools that aren't making the standard. And so the question becomes, what's the issue? Mm-hmm. Is it a funding issue? Is it a family issue? Is it a is it a school performance issue? And that's where, you know, the education funding relationship gets complicated because it's easy for schools on the North Shore where they pretty much can get 100% passing the state standards. In fact, you know, they would probably argue that the state standards are too low for them. Yeah. But on the other hand, if you look at other parts of the state, we have large numbers of schools, 200, 300, 400 schools that aren't making the state standards. And the other critical element to that is that they've also disaggregated this information by 9 different categories, including race and poverty and special education. So, again, it's forced people to look at this in a different way than they've ever done it before.
Well, okay. So let me ask this question then. What is the average per pupil spending in the state of Illinois?
Well, it's the average is about 65. It ranges 6,700. And that, again, is in 2006. And, again, okay. that changes on an annual basis. But the more interesting thing to some degree is the range.
The top and what's the bottom?
Yeah. Which goes and the state does have a basic foundation level, but it does go up to $23,000 per pupil.
So the spread is just it's huge between what the most affluent district has and what they can spend on their students and what the least has. And that's one of these things that now for forever people, and not just in state of Illinois, have said, look, this is a problem. This is a serious problem, that this difference between the wealthy districts and the less wealthy, and that somehow the state should do something about that. And I suppose that one of the things that has done is that the amount of the state is in there has been bumped up a little bit. Someone has said it should be at least at X amount of dollars.
Right.
But that still really doesn't do anything to address this enormous difference.
Disparity. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and I guess that's kind of the question about, you know, how funds are distributed. I think one of the key issues is the state has in its constitution is said to be the primary guarantor of education, K-12 education. Sure. And I think that becomes the question where now, just like higher education, the percentage of those dollars have gone down to now we're about 36%, and the communities have continued to fill in, particularly the communities that can fill in. Yeah. And the problem is the communities that have had a hard time passing referendum to keep up with these communities.
We have a number of callers. In fact, the lines are full. So I want to get to them in just a second, but before we do that, let me just ask one more question. And we were talking a little bit about this before we got going. For a long time now in the state of Illinois, people have been saying that we should change the way that schools are funded. Now, primarily, what we're relying on is property tax. And that's one of the reasons that you see this big spread. And some people, particularly people downstate who live in rural areas and where agriculture is big, they're concerned about their tax bill. And people are concerned about this difference between the wealthiest districts and the ones that are on the bottom. And so they have said, this doesn't make any sense to do it like this, and have suggested various things. And I guess the big thing is to move away from the property tax and probably go to some other kind of tax. With some fiddling around of, you know, how much revenue is generated and the percentage where it comes from. You know, different people will have different sorts of solutions. But here the issue is, we've been talking about this for a long time. Everybody says that would be a great thing to do, but it never happens. And I think a lot of people would say, politically speaking, this is next to impossible to have this happen. I'm sure people will be talking about it again in the General Assembly. Do you think there's really any chance of this?
There's a bill just last year again. Well, every year there's a bill.
Yeah, and we have commissions that come up with and say, mm-hmm. yes, we should do this, and it doesn't seem to be something that's actually doable. Do you think that, in fact, that it's something that's actually doable?
Not this year.
That's a good answer. It has been done in other states.
There have been some states that have massive changes. And, of course, there's, as usual, and one of the concerns is there's some winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the issue that becomes very guarded for local communities to decide how that works.
Well, let me get to the phones here, and also for people who have just tuned in, I better introduce again our guest, Elizabeth Powers. She is an economist and is also affiliated with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And also here in studio with us is Peter Mulhall. He's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs Center for Prevention and Research and Development. We really like long titles here, don't we? And both of them are contributors to the Illinois Report for 2008. It's been put out by IGPA, looking at different key issues here in the state of Illinois. The second year they've done this, you can, I'm sure, get a hard copy from them. But also I know that if you go to their website, the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, you can read there. The whole thing is available there for you to look at. So if you want to do that, you can check it out. And here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Some of our callers, I guess, changed their mind or lost patience with us. My apologies. We'll go right away to a caller in Rantoul, line one. Hello. Caller there in Rantoul, line one.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah,
can
go,
you hear me?
Yeah, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
I used to live up in Crescent City, Illinois. I was on the school board up there. Population 600, grand total of 180 kids, K through 12. Average tuition, $11,000 per student. My question goes to, I spent some time down in Texas, particularly the Matagorda Bay area. And down there, at least in a region, they had passed what they called a Robin Hood law. Wondered if your guests could comment on that. Thank you.
Is the caller still there?
Yeah, still here.
Because I think that Peter's not sure what that means. Robin Hood. Can you explain what that is?
Oh, well, that's just an equal distribution of funding for education across several districts. Still funded with property taxes. That's why they called it a Robin Hood law.
So some money is going from the rich people and it's going to the poor people, right?
Right. Okay. Well, and, you know, I mean, if you're talking about here in Illinois, I mean, I'm also from Ohio, and I know that there's school districts out there where the average tuition is $2,800 to $3,200 per student in, like, Logan County, but you get out to other counties and it's up in the $30,000 range. So, but at any rate, if you wanted to comment on that.
And I guess I would, first of all, one of the things that we do know is that it does, that kids aren't all equal in terms of becoming educated, however we define that might be, you know. So there are some special criteria set up for kids with special education, which completely makes sense, with kids who schools receive additional funding for larger percentages of free reduced lunch. And so we do know that those are, you know, differences. The feds pay a lot of that. The state has to kick in that as well. And that's why I say, in some ways, we really don't have a particular unit cost. School districts and the state doesn't do as good a job with the finance piece. I think that one of the recommendations that I make in here is that there needs to be a better way to track this. We seem to be able to do it in lots of others, but education, to some degree, that's probably led by the feds. But I think they are looking at a financing system to do a better job at it.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I mean, Robin Hood is, you know, robs from the rich to give to the poor. In any education reform, we're really talking about redistribution. And this is, I think, why we've started down the road so many times and not made it to the end of the path. We're talking about redistributing from wealthier areas of the state, wealthier neighborhoods, to less wealthy neighborhoods. Relating back to the whole question of poverty, we've shown as a country, an unwillingness to simply solve the kind of transitory poverty problem by simply increasing transfers to households and making them not poor through government transfers. Mm-hmm. If we want to solve, if we want to make a dent in poverty rates, which we haven't in 30 years, we really do need to talk about redistribution in a way to change people's life course. And that's really the education piece. Mm-hmm. And an education reform that the redistributed resources that are available to people to make investments would from everything we know about the returns to education, for example, the financial returns to education, would be a real move towards reducing poverty in a permanent way.
Yeah. And I guess as far as I know, mostly what people would be talking about would indeed be to move away from the property taxes being the method of funding, I guess, and it would be going to an income tax, which would probably mean you'd have to increase the income tax. And the promise is that there would be some offsetting cut in property
tax.
Nobody believes it. Well, that's why it's never gone anywhere in Springfield, because nobody believes that. Mm-hmm. When they say to you, oh, you're not going to be paying more in taxes, people say, yeah, right, sure. They don't think that they're going to get the property tax relief. They just think they're going to get an income tax increase. So, but at least that's that would be the idea. So I suppose then that would mean that more money would go into the state budget, and then the state would distribute that, and then it would decide how much each district was going to get.
And I think, you know, they have a pretty standard system where they establish a foundation level, and districts get that, and they get supplements for different qualities and characteristics of their population. So I think some of those adjustments are to be made. Now, on the other hand, I also want to say that we need to do a better job at educating our kids. So, I know we talk about financing as part of it, and I guess my view has always been that, you know, yes, it takes money to do it. Mm-hmm. It's a necessary, but just the money alone is not going to be sufficient to do this properly. In fact, in the analysis that I did for this, I looked at schools that were high performers and high funded, and I also looked at schools that were low funded and high performers, you know, and then I looked at schools that were low performers and high funded, and then I looked at schools who were low funded and low performers, which is sort of a common type of analysis to do. And, you know, and it does come down to what sort of Elizabeth alluded to earlier, it begins to focus on the urban side and the rural side. And that's where you're seeing the schools that are really struggling with both, primarily with the achievement side of the equation, mm-hmm. But the rural schools are really, in many cases, far underfunded, and the results are kids are not achieving at a level. So there's a real issue there. Now, there are schools that are being funded fairly well by many standards that aren't performing, and I think that requires a whole set of other considerations to be made, which range from leadership issues, teacher practices, family engagement, and a host of other issues that we know. On the other hand, you know, we really don't have good examples in this country of doing a good job of educating disadvantaged kids. We can do it. We have some examples of one school or a small project, but overall, we don't have any really shining stars out there about how we took a city or larger that can be really generalized or carried over to lots of other communities. So there's still a lot of questions to be answered about how that process works. Yeah. Some people want vouchers. Some people want charter schools. Some people have different. But the evidence with those is not as strong as at least the advocates would like to think they are. Yeah.
Let's get another call here in Belgium, not too far away, over in Vermilion County, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start you down a line that I'm afraid is probably an example you have not touched on yet, and we may be fairly unique. I'm over here in East Central Illinois, Danville particularly. My wife is a teacher in this district, okay? So I do know a little bit what I'm talking about here. She, as things happened this year, of her students, over half are Section 8 students. Many of those students are from the Chicagoland area, if not Chicago. Now, this started me down a line of reasoning that I just can't get my head around. Chicagoland has decided to move or encourage some people to move from some areas, and downstate is a very much more reasonable place to use your Section 8 dollar. Now these individuals have come down here. They don't bring the resources of the education with them. The community now has to pay for their education. These students come with some fairly serious issues, and I'm not going to get into any of that. Now, we, on a local basis, now this is a small community that has a lot of excess housing because we have gone through some very serious downturns in industry. Used to be a 50,000-person town. It's now a 30,000-person town. Obviously, you have a lot of open homes, a lot of availability for Section 8. So now we have a lot of Section 8 people here. I know what happens in other portions of the state. But now we are being required to educate students from Chicago. Now, shouldn't Chicago have to pay for some of these students they've been educating for the last, well, in these cases, 6 years, 5 years?
Well, either you can comment on that either way you like. It's a tough it's a tough question.
Well, I guess what I would say, I mean, I guess, you know, the only response I would have to that is, given the way the system's funded today, all right, and I think he's primarily talking about Danville.
Yes, sir.
Danville doesn't have the resources to do this.
No.
And so because the preponderance of funding comes right now from the property tax, it's very difficult to make any adjustment to the circumstances or the situation.
And the sad thing about it is our property is the businesses that did pay the highest property tax are gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it now falls all strictly on the individual, and I guess, well, mainly just the individual, because there's not a whole lot of farmers inside the city limits.
And that would, again, be, you know, sort of the argument for if we had an income tax basis for this, the distribution or formulas that could be put together would be able to address communities with changing needs, rapidly changing needs like this.
Yeah. I mean, the whole problem with the property tax, too, is you do have these extremes, right? So you have to look to the other side, too, which is the wealthy districts are happy that schooling is funded by the property tax. Mm-hmm. What worries them about reform is that they won't be allowed to invest as much in their children after the reform. So, you know, you've got this kind of standoff between wealthy districts that like the property tax because they're able to use their resources for an important activity. But then you've got, as you say, you've got a situation where you are actually asked to do more, it seems, and yet you don't. There's no more left in the well, right? There's no more in the property values to go to.
The thing I want to point out, ma'am, is that these students are really coming from a wealthier area and moving to a much poorer area, and then the poorer area being required to educate.
But they're in Section 8. They can't be very well to do.
No, but they're coming from an area that wants to transform a housing project into high-rise hotel apartments that are going to be worth a whole lot more money. Mm-hmm. See what I'm pointing out, ma'am?
Sure.
That's not right at all.
Well, that's the current system. Also, there's no money follows the student, right?
Mm-hmm.
Peter can speak to this better in terms of you're saying basically that you have an influx of higher need students, mm-hmm, who should be better funded because they need more resources, and yet there's no mechanism to do that.
Precisely. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's continue. We'll talk next with someone in Urbana, I believe, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Line one?
Yes.
I believe there is the last caller puts a finger on a much bigger issue, because we have a problem about local control. We like to believe that every community needs to have control over its schools, its curricula, and other matters. And as a result, there is a resistance to increasing state-level funding and sort of a loss of control, as one of your speakers just said, that some communities may be reluctant to be quote-unquote not allowed to fund higher than the other solutions would allow. The question is, if the funding were given in a more equitable manner, these communities would not have to fund at a higher level, because the requirements of education have changed in the meantime. You cannot say that children in Southern Illinois need less mathematics than children in Chicago. We all live in a world that requires pretty much equal education. And some of the European countries are doing something like a centrally funded education system. I'd like to hear some comments on that. And the second question I had was about the tax level that we have. It's my understanding that Illinois ranks one of the lowest income tax states in the country. It's, of course, a little confusing probably because we here pay taxes at so many different levels that it's hard to put a finger on one tax rate and say we are lowest funded. We may ultimately be paying as much of our income in taxes as some of the European countries do, except we do that at state, at city, at so many different levels. I'll just hang up on this.
All right.
Thank you.
I think he raises some interesting questions. I think it is the case that Illinois is not a particularly high tax
state. Illinois is a very low tax state, I believe, even when you factor in the other sources of revenue. And we certainly don't approach any kind of European level of taxation. And we do, you know, correspondingly, we have not at all extravagant public services relative to other states also. And that is, I think Peter can speak to this better. Is a direct consequence of that. Overall, public education is quite low funded relative to other.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, David, how we did some sort of regional comparisons,
right.
And just you know, if you take a look at Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin. I think even Elizabeth alluded to that earlier, but Wisconsin. Their adjusted per pupil expenditure is $9,400, which is $1,400 more than the state of Illinois. Now, that's older data, but that's a lot. $1,400 is a lot of money. Yeah. And so the implications, I think, are there for the fact that Wisconsin, you know, state that's got a lot of commonality, doesn't have a big city like Chicago. But you know, they are spending. There is a commitment there to spend more. And so I think that is – and even to some degree, Indiana has tried to address these issues in a better way. And a lot of this has to do with, in my opinion, sort of the political gridlock. Everybody talks about education, and people use it as sort of a pawn against, you know, for different pet projects, et cetera, et cetera. So it's out there. I think there are certainly people who are committed to making some changes, but certainly we haven't gotten at the level where we're ready to go ahead and make that swap that we talked about earlier.
Well, I think the caller raises another point, and I think that for a lot of people, one important feature of education is that it is locally controlled because we have locally elected mm-hmm. school boards and they're making the decisions, mm-hmm. and then the money that supports the school is also locally raised from local resources. Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe one of the reasons that people might be reluctant to go to a different kind of system is indeed that they think that somehow that means that they're going to be giving up local control if they're going to be relying on the state to decide how much money that they're going to get back?
Unquestionably. In fact, you may recall that one of the solutions to the Chicago educational program was local school councils. They wanted to give, you know, parents and local folks a greater sense of control, hiring, mm-hmm. making decisions about administrators, et cetera, et cetera. So local control does have potentially some benefits. But again, I think, you know, from a state perspective, you need to step back and take the larger view and see, you know, where the specific issues are. Now, on the other hand, I think, you know, we can't go without saying that our schools need to get better. Our teachers need to get better. You know, teachers are falling behind the technology, particularly in those communities that don't have strong connections with universities or have strong connections with urban centers. They are potentially falling behind. So I do think that there needs to be some fundamental changes within the school building itself. and leadership is part of that. But it is a tussle. I mean, we've seen it go on here in Champaign-Urbana with the school boards and the struggles that they've had. Mm-hmm. So local control, I don't think it's going to go away. Maybe some creative way to figure out how to finance it, to work through it.
There's no reason in principle why you can't maintain local governance of the schools with, say, a higher foundation level of funding.
Well, and is also part of this deal saying to school districts that what the state's going to do is that they're basically going to hand out the money, and because we want the resources to be more equal. But then are they still saying to the local districts, but if you want to spend more money,
right,
you can. We're not going to tell you that you can't. So, and then if that's the case, then I guess I wonder, are we still going to have the same problem? Maybe the spread's not going to be as wide, but we're still going to have a spread.
Right. And that's why I think we also have to look at some outcomes when it comes to, you know, are we getting some value, for the money that's being put into it? So I think that has to be part of the equation too, rather than just the amount of the inputs, the dollars going in. And so as a result of that, to some degree, No Child Left Behind starts that process. There's a lot of other thinking going on. One of the points that I try to make in the document is the issue that, you know, academic achievement and the measurement of those are really fairly narrow, fairly limited. If you ask any employer, they're not just looking for someone who can calculate something. Or there's a lot more skills that are necessary, and the schools are really struggling with how to incorporate some of those things.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and we have two guests with us. Peter Mulhall, he's director of the Center for Prevention Research and Development that is within the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the U of I. Also, Elizabeth Powers is here. She is a professor, associate professor of economics, and is also affiliated with the Institute. And both of them are contributors to a report that has come out fairly recently here by the Institute. It's the Illinois Report for 2008 that looks at a number of key issues affecting the state. You can, I'm sure, get a copy from them, or if you want to go online, go to their website, and I know that you can read it. The total complete text is there. And let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to Paxton, line two, for the next caller. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting
sure.
show. Just a couple of quick observations that I'll offer up to your guests for comment. Perhaps they can draw their own conclusions. Trying to get to the core of this situation, which is a very sad situation, but I'm just wondering, would your guests draw any correlation to the fact that somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% or 80% of kids now are coming from single families, in other words, unwed mothers, and if you kind of follow them through demographics, they're more likely to do poorly in school, more likely to drop out of school, and in fact, more likely to end up in prisons than someplace else. And I'm just wondering, unless that trend turns around, and I can't see it turning around anytime soon, won't, in fact, our school systems continue to suffer? And, in fact, isn't that the core, perhaps one of the core problems of the issue, the kids, 70-80% of them coming from broken homes? That seems like a very taxing situation, and I'll go ahead and listen off to air. Thanks.
Okay. I'm sure that's the kind of thing that you have looked at.
Yeah, no, I would agree that is a, you know, single parenthood in itself may or may not be the problem, but the things that go with it, for example, almost a quarter of poor people in Illinois are children who live with a lone female parent, as I mentioned earlier. So the lack of resources that those households have, the lack of the ability of a single parent who's also trying to work to be attentive to what's going on in the home, what's going on at school. You know, we haven't touched on parent involvement with school children. Parent involvement in the schools is very important. I agree with the caller that this is a core problem, and with regard to poverty and education both. With regard to education, you know, many people who have looked at the U.S. In an international perspective and this perception that we don't keep up with other countries in regard to science and math and generally test scores and all different subject areas, many people have pointed out that we have a more heterogeneous group of children, including children, many children coming from difficult circumstances, high poverty or low resource circumstances, and that our schools don't seem to do the system that we've been discussing here does not seem to do a particularly good job in compensating for those challenges. So I completely agree with the caller. It is a core issue in both.
One thing I want to make sure that we at least mention, because one thing we can say is that your success in school and the level of education that you attained are a big predictor on how well you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of people would argue that this whole process starts very early. One of the things that I think is noteworthy here about the state of Illinois, and you mentioned it in the section of report that you've done, is that we're looking at trying to provide early childhood ed for 3- and 4-year-olds to anybody who wants it. It's not the kind of thing it would be required, but it would be there and it would be available. And I think that it's true, at least I think that you're right in the report, that if that actually happens, Illinois would be the first state to do that. Is that right, that nobody else does that? Other state does that?
We started down the road first and in the most aggressive way. There are some other states coming along with universal preschool now. I guess one thing I'd like to speak to that entire issue, and it's discussed in the chapter, is that, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you could just throw money at families that are poor and raise their income to a dollar above the poverty level, and you could say that you've solved the poverty problem. That is a policy that we have Americans have not chosen to adopt. And it's kind of, you could say that's good because it's kind of a superficial policy in some ways too. But the poverty issue, it's really clear now through the research that's been done that's been able to track people over time and also to track people from generation to generation. The poverty problem now is really an intergenerational problem fundamentally. Sure, there are always people who have some bad events, fall below the poverty line. We'd like to help them. They need some immediate cash assistance. We've got to help them. But the really solving the poverty problem is going to involve, as you say, these kind of very early interventions to put people on a different path than their parents, basically, at this point. The studies that have been done show that people's own earnings as adults track their parents' earnings very closely. Their educational attainment tracks their parents' educational attainment very closely. So we really do need to intervene very early in the lives of children in poor, low-resource households if we're going to break this cycle down. So Illinois started a couple of things, or a couple of policies that relate to early childhood education. One is simply under welfare reform, there was a dramatic decline in cash assistance for households, but this was replaced with lots of money for child care, new money for child care. And so we have many children in care who formerly would have been at home with welfare-receiving parents, and they're now in child care that is subsidized heavily by the state. Now, one thing I would pick at that program a little bit is that the vast majority of about a third of those children are really in licensed center care. So we're paying for a lot of care that through the child care subsidy program that may not be the best quality care. And one of my questions would be, you know, should the state try to address that issue and spend its state dollars on better quality care than it is currently, perhaps. And then the other issue, as you raised, is universal preschool. That is going ahead, despite all the budget woes and fights. They're continuing to chip away and expand the availability of universal preschool. And again, you know, that faces a similar issue that it funds actually all types of organizations can offer preschool programs. And I think we should be asking what are the best early learning programs. Let's focus these dollars on funding those good early learning experiences, because the studies that have been done of preschool programs for children from low resource households in other states suggest they can be very effective.
I want to try to get at least one more caller here, and we have a couple of minutes left. So this is someone in Urbana on line 3, I believe. Hello.
Well, the person from Danville, I think, touched upon a problem that's rather wider than the one being discussed. But I'm not an expert in the area, but I think I can briefly state the problem is seen by the minority population in South Chicago, that they see the gentrification that is occurring there as a targeted program to push them out and essentially dump the low-income problems of South Chicago onto surrounding communities. And they would also claim, I think, that it is causing the destruction of the local community. Would you care to comment upon this?
Go ahead.
And do you see it as a problem? Thank you.
Okay. So the idea for kind of dispersing people in Chicago who had been concentrated in projects, housing projects, like Cabrini Green would be a famous housing project. The idea behind that was that these are not good neighborhoods, they're not good environments for children. Let's get these people more into regular housing arrangements, interspersed with middle class people, basically being in a better school district. We talked about how the local wealth is so important for the quality of school. So that was initially, I think, how this was sold as a policy. However, you know, from the point of view of people in those projects as well, you know, you are basically disbanding their community. So with welfare reform being implemented about a decade ago, you know, there's not a lot of cash resources for people who need them. So even if you have small children and are in a situation where you've got to move out of a housing project, let's say, your options are quite limited. Welfare assistance is time limited. There's lots of you need to get into the workforce even to continue receiving welfare assistance. And so I guess in some ways it would be a logical, rational thing for a person to attempt to go to a lower cost community where they can actually afford to live on their limited means. So, I mean, from the point of view of the individual, gentrification definitely pushes people to move into lower cost areas. They have to.
Yeah. We are at the point here. We have about 2 minutes or less. So, as a way of finishing up, let me ask you, how would you? At this point, let's say just talk about poverty. How would you say that the state of Illinois, the government of the state of Illinois, has done in trying to, address the needs of the most disadvantaged people in the state?
Well, I don't think Illinois has done particularly well. But I would say, and I think it's clear from the material I present in my chapter, that the country has not done particularly well. It has not been a particularly important goal of the country to reduce poverty, and therefore we basically are at the same poverty rate now that we were at in 1975. And as I said, we've kind of punted on this whole idea that we should provide immediate cash relief to people, you know, even though it seems like the obvious thing to do. And I think Illinois is doing as well and better than many other states in emphasizing early intervention in the educational system, because one thing that's emerged clearly from the research on income is that it's an intergenerational phenomenon, and we've got to intervene early in people's lives to move them onto that more education, more income track.
And as far as school funding is concerned, I feel that this is one of those things where we've had this conversation more than once, and it sounds like we're going to continue to be talking about this, but whether very much changes, chances are probably not very much, at least not in the immediate future.
So I guess my view is that, you know, sort of incrementalism is alive and well in state government, and, you know, it's one of those things is you really can't fix a system that's almost fundamentally flawed. That's something more drastic, more, you know, and I always use the toll road metaphor because people, I think toll roads are bad in general, but just because you have an open toll road doesn't make it any better. It's still a toll. So we have fundamentally flawed school funding system, and so something more dramatic has to happen, or we're just going to keep sort of, like I said, incrementally coming close to continue to have the problems as the more affluent folks can afford it and the other schools struggle.
Well, at that, we have to thanks to our guest, Peter Mulhall. He is director of the Center for Prevention Research and Development within the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois, and also Elizabeth Powers. She is associate professor of economics and is also affiliated with IGPA, and they're both contributors to this year's Illinois report. The Institute put it out looking at a number of issues facing the state. You can get a copy from them, or if you have internet access, you can read it online. Just go to their website, and it's all there. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The broadcast today made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. Information at 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Before we go, I would like to mention that tomorrow morning on the program, we'll be doing a show that's very much connected with some of the things we've been talking about here this morning. We'll be talking about school accountability and performance in the era of No Child Left Behind. And there our guest will be Liz DeStefano. She is Executive Associate Dean for Research and Administration here at the U of I, and also Director of the Bureau of Educational Research. So we'll be talking a little bit about that, and that, I believe, will be in the 11 o'clock hour. And then in the first hour, we'll talk with Alan Guelzo about a new book that he has written about the Lincoln and Douglas debates. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We welcome your questions and calls right now. We hope you'll stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be writer and historian Eve LaPlante, author of Salem Witch Judge, The Life and Repentance of Samuel Sewall. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening with the commodity markets in Kansas City. March wheat is trading at $13.30. That is up 15. In Chicago, May wheat $12.87, up 4.5. July $12.45, unchanged. March corn $5.64.5, up 7.75. May $5.76, up 8.75. July $5.87.5, up 8. December $5.85.75, up 6.75. March beans 14.00, up 21. May 14.17, up 22. July 14.29, up 18.5. November 13.31, that up 13.75. March meal 351.80, up 6.30. May oil 63.43, up 1.19. At the Merck in Chicago, April live cattle 89.55, down 77.5. June 90.90, down 112.5. March feeder cattle 99.05, down 72.5. April 101.60, down 110. And April lean hogs 57.47.5, down 27.5.